password?
I don't password control my computer. It's sitting there. I have to be a little bit used to Linux to have that work, because it's not in Word. So, questions? Yeah, so the sun exploding was a 10-point question on an old exam, and it's kind of a standard. I would be thinking that that's a good question to be studying for. So the sun is on some old exams, so you're safe on that one. I think it's the biology that's a little bit trickier, because I don't think there are any old exams out there that had any biology on them. There won't be a lot of biology on your exam, but you can ask questions other than what's the question on biology. I'll try and answer them.
Twenty-six on exam three.
I think exam three is the one that I've got. The Earth's twin questions. So why do the Earth and the Venus have different amounts of carbon dioxide? So the best guess is this isn't kind of a problem with Venus, it's kind of a problem with Earth. That is to say, we think that the Earth had a large carbon dioxide atmosphere early on, and now it's got lots of carbonate rocks. So the carbon dioxide dissolves in the oceans and then it precipitates out as limestone. For the other part, Venus has much less water. So the very common way to lose points on this is to say that the water evaporated. Right? So evaporated water is water. You haven't lost any water if you've evaporated it. So we have to totally destroy the water. And obviously Earth is the one with the water, so presumably we want to destroy it on Venus. And what we think happened is that Venus is hot enough and lacks an ozone layer, so the water could rise high in Venus's atmosphere where the UV light could get to it and break it apart. The hydrogen is then light enough that it can escape the planet, and the oxygen can then, it's a reactive gas, it can end up in rocks. So Earth's carbon dioxide went into the oceans. Venus's water was broken apart, and one piece went up and one piece went down. Same exam, 30?
Which exam?
We're exam 3, 30. Describe the environment on the surface of Saturn's moon Titan. So there are lots of things you could say. So we have a few pictures from the surface, and it looks pretty flat. And actually, people thought there might be a splash, but there wasn't a splash. There were bare rocks there. And what we have are these hydrocarbon lakes, and we think we have hydrocarbon rain, and we certainly have hydrocarbon clouds, where hydrocarbons are methane and ethane. No impact craters have been spotted, so something has to be resurfacing the surface. Lots of people said volcanoes, and I didn't take off any points for that, because maybe, but the early data that suggested volcanoes, cryovolcanoes, isn't hacking out. They haven't found any of the pits that they should have for craters. So it could be they just haven't looked hard enough, and there are volcanoes that are resurfacing. But another option is erosion, right? If we've got all this rain falling, it's the same thing that erases the craters on Earth. You have rain and it fills them all in. Surface features, so it's 100% cloudy, cold, nitrogen atmosphere. Define and give an example of resonance. This is probably the most commonly missed question. You're hitting all the, these are ones you missed. Huh? These are all very commonly missed questions. So resonance is our cases where we have exact multiple matches of periods. So kind of the standard example are the moons of Jupiter or the rings of Saturn. In the case of the moons of Jupiter, the three inner moons, the innermost one takes exactly one quarter as long as the outer one takes to go around, and the second one takes exactly half as long as the outer one takes to go around. And under these sorts of circumstances where we have exact period matches, you get interactions at exactly the same spot in the orbit. They'll be close together. And that means that that orbit won't tend to be, will be perturbed away from circularity. Generally speaking, we think things that are in close will have fairly circular orbits. And what that's doing in the case of the moons of Jupiter is it's driving a relatively small but non-zero eccentricity. And so that's, I mean, we're now getting into kind of another story. So that's leading to the tidal heating. So resonance is exact matches of periods so that you get the same perturbation every time, and it leads to distortions of those orbits. In the rings of Saturn, what we do is eliminate those particles, because if they get a small eccentricity, then they'll be pushed into neighboring particles. Same thing with the Kirkwood gaps in the asteroid belt. And there's also a resonance between Pluto and Neptune, so that they, in that case, it's so that they have, whenever they're close together, they're not. One's up and one's down. They're not at these intersection points that you seem to see in the orbits. That's a true and falser, huh? So you know that the answer, the question is why, huh? So strong Coriolis force, oops, right? So Coriolis force requires spin, right? It has to do with planets spinning. And Venus is spinning really slow. I think it's the slowest spinning planet. So no large Coriolis force for Venus, and so as a result, we don't have all of the things that we associate with Coriolis forces here on Earth. The high and low pressure systems, the multiple Hadley cells, none of that does Venus have. It may well have thunderstorms, but I actually haven't heard. Most of the other planets do have thunderstorms and they actually see lightning bolts on them, but I can't remember reading that about Venus. And let me say one more thing. So there's another true and false question that had to do with acid rain hitting the ground on Venus. I think that might have been on an old exam. Yeah. And the answer is no, right? It's too hot. The water would evaporate before it would hit the ground if there are thunderstorms.
Sorry.
You're sorry.
I interrupted
you. Go ahead.
Define equant. What phenomena causes Ptolemy to use equants?
So say, so I heard the word equants. What are the words before equants?
Just define.
Oh, define equant and?
It was just what phenomenon caused Ptolemy to use quants.
So Ptolemy, we're thinking geocentric, we're thinking all of that sort of stuff. And what the equant is it's a way of making a planet in a geocentric. So back to the original idea was that everything was moving in circles at constant speed. And it just doesn't work out. If you look at, I'll call it the orbit of the sun, because that's what they would have called it. If you look at the orbit of the sun around the Earth, the time it takes to go through the four various seasons isn't the same. So March 21, June 21, September 21, December 21, it may sound like the same number of days in those seasons, but they're not, right? They're different numbers of months. And what that means is that sometimes the sun is moving a little bit faster than it's moving at other times. And the same thing is true with all of the other planets. They're not moving at a uniform rate. And that's kind of in contradiction to what Aristotle would have suspected. So the game to make planets move at different rates was the follow. So we have our perfect circle for, say, the sun or for Mars or something like that. And we don't put the Earth at the center of the circle. We put it off to the side. And then there's a magical point that is as far from the, I'll label it Q, it's as far from the center as the Earth was from the center. And that's the point that is moving at uniform rate. So if you put a stick that's going out from there, it's moving at an exactly uniform rate. And that means that here, the planet is going to be going slower because it's closer to the center of the stick than when it's over here. When it's further from the center of the stick, it's going to be moving faster.
So then it moves faster when it's away from the sun, would you say? Or it would be moving faster when it's closer?
Well, so this is all geocentric stuff, right? So it's not the sun. So here, things are going to be moving faster when they're close to the Earth, and they're going to be moving slower when they're away from the Earth. And this is, of course, all similar but different from Kepler's third law, right? Where we have the same phenomena, except now we've got elliptical orbits and we've got the sun, and things are moving fast when they're close to the sun and they're moving slow when they're away from the sun. So kind of the facts had to be reproduced in this circular, perfect motion sort of way, and that's how they did it. That's how Ptolemy did it. So the equant is the point at which you get uniform circular motion about, which is not where the Earth is, and it's not where the center of the circle is. So this term geocentric is not exactly correct. Things weren't literally centered on the Earth. The Earth was a little bit off center. And presumably, I mean, Aristotle was long dead when Ptolemy was writing. Presumably, Aristotle would not have been happy with this, right? Because the whole philosophy required the Earth to be at the center. But the data required the Earth not to be at the center. So that was the way Ptolemy worked it out. Thirty-six on exam three. Must be a long question. Ah, so this is the kind of meteorological question. Comes in two parts. So we've got this bullseye pattern, which are isobars, and that's telling you what the pressure is, and there are numbers on them. And every place on this circle, for example, the pressure might be 990. And they're working their way up to the center, so that had to be a high pressure system there. And we have this point that's off to the side, and it's between things that are labeled 995 and 1,000. It's kind of there. So the pressure there has to be, you know, kind of pick your favorite number between 995 and 1,000. 997 looks like a pretty good choice. The real part of the harder part of the question is to figure out which way the wind is blowing at that location. And what we have is the geostrophic balance, which says that the pressure force, and if this is high pressure, there's going to be a pressure force that's pushing that thing that way, has to be balanced by a Coriolis force. And Coriolis force is to the right, so the only way we can have a Coriolis force that is pushing in the right direction is if the wind is going down at this location. So And this was a problem grading. I'm not sure how to solve that problem. Is the answer north or south? All right, because it's a wind from the north, which people will call a north wind. But I think most people would call that a south. I mean, looking at the graph, people would say a south wind. So I think if I could figure out what you meant, I tried to grade it right. But this arrow that's going down towards the south is the way the wind would be blowing. Incidentally, if this was in the southern hemisphere, then things would be reversed, right? The Coriolis force would be to the left, has to still point the same direction, but now to the left would be that way. Say again? No, the wind never goes the same way as the Coriolis force, right? Because they're, technically speaking, it's a cross product. So the Coriolis force is always perpendicular to the Coriolis force. So another way of remembering this, if you don't like that way, is to kind of imagine how the high pressure system could have started to form. This would have all been over very quickly, but you can imagine that the air would try to escape this high pressure system. And if we're in the northern hemisphere, it would be pushed to the right. And you can see it's going to end up then going around like that. So the other question was the one I think that was harder for more people. And again, the first part is to figure out the pressures, and that's mostly just a matter of looking at the graph, right? I hope you can see that B is maybe 975 and A is 965. And so the pressure at A is less than the pressure at B, right? Just reading the lines. So B is a high pressure, A is a low pressure. So this was, I said, 975, and this was 965. So there's a pressure force that's trying to push the air from A to B. And how can that be? Well, we have to have a Coriolis force that's balancing it. And the only way that could happen is if the wind was blowing into the piece of paper. Then to the right would be a force that would exactly balance that pressure force. And that's what the geostrophic balance promises us. So if you work that out, that's a wind that's blowing towards the north, given that this way is east. So is it a south wind since it's blowing towards the north? I don't know. I wish it were unambiguous. Ah, so that was another part of this question. How to figure out what the temperature is given by these diagrams. And what you should remember, of course, is the change in pressure that's related to the weight of the air. So if we look below A and compare that to below B, the change in pressure going from ground level to A, that's more than the change in pressure going from ground level to point B. So that means that the air below A has to weigh more than the air that's below B. So that means it has to be denser and therefore colder. Okay, so the rate that the pressure goes down with altitude depends on the density of the fluid we're talking about. It goes down faster in denser material, right? So if you're going up in the ocean, the pressure goes up really quickly as you go up, right? So you can get the bends just going a few tens of meters, whereas you, in air, if you go up a few tens of meters, nothing bad ever happens to you.
Could you go over the equation for entropy?
The equation for entropy.
Change of G equals change of H.
Yeah, so that's, So I wouldn't call that an equation for entropy. This is the entropy. And this is, technically speaking, it's the entropy, but we'll call this the energy. And this is called Gibbs free energy. And for a reaction to occur spontaneously, Gibbs free, you have to go downhill. Gibbs free energy has to decrease. So one way of doing that is to go downhill, to go from a high energy state to a low energy state. That would give you a delta G that's negative. But if when you do that, you produce a more disordered state, that would be good, right? That would also produce a negative sign. But if you produced a more ordered state, that would be less entropy, then with this minus sign, that would be fighting it. So the upshot is that the universe likes to go to a low energy state and it likes to go to a disordered state, right? Both of those would produce negative signs there. Which one wins depends on the temperature. If the temperature is huge, then getting more disorder will be more important than going to lower energy. If we're at very low temperatures, then going to low energy will be more important than whether you order something or disorder something. So if we want to make an ordered structure like DNA, it sounds like we want to do it at low temperatures. But you go to too low temperatures and the rates of the reactions get real small. So the mantra, high temperatures break apart composites, that's a consequence of that equation. Because obviously a broken apart molecule has lots more disorder than a linked together molecule. So even if it takes energy to break a molecule apart, it'll happen at high enough temperature. So if anything, this is a definition of Gibbs free energy. So, I didn't bring my exam too. 26. The lens problem. So, we got a couple of lenses here, and I tell you the diameter and the focal length. And we're supposed to ask questions like who's going to burn faster and which one is going to make the biggest images. So the size of the, when you're burning ants or something like that, you get this little circle on the piece of paper. That's the image of the sun. So if you want to have a big circle, big burned area, you want to have a big image of the sun. And the image, the size of the image depends on the focal length. So the bigger the focal length, the bigger the image of the sun, and in this particular problem, B is the one with the biggest focal length, so it's the one that's going to have the biggest image of the sun and the biggest hole. Now we want to be real careful between these words. We've got focal length, and we've got F number. I don't know if they sound the same to you or not, but I won't say they're unrelated, but they're not the same thing. So the focal length, that's the distance to the focused image, as we were just saying, and bigger, the longer that distance, the bigger the image. The F number is the ratio of the focal length divided by the diameter. And that determined the image brightness. How bright is that dot that is the sun? Which determines how fast you're going to burn your ants. And you can see what's favored for a small f number, small is bright is going to be a big diameter. And if we calculate these numbers, the F number for the first lens is going to be 2 divided by 2, or 1, and the F number of the second lens is going to be 6 divided by 3, or 2. So lens A has the smaller F number, an F number of 1, and so it's going to burn things faster. It's going to make brighter images.
Could you describe the changes in the sun as it evolves from its main sequence to final depth, since we haven't really built too much of that?
I can, but I guarantee you there won't be any question like that on your exam.
What sun questions should we expect?
So those that are in that chapter, which is, I forget, is it 16, Our Sun?
16.
And also things that we talked about, right? The word main sequence didn't occur in this course.
You think you could briefly go over the process of hydrogen burning in the sun?
Mm-hmm. So the question in one of these exams looks kind of like the following. There's a black, big black dot and another big black dot, and I have it going to a white dot and a black dot, and plus a new, plus a smaller dot. And then I have this combination plus that going to white with two of those guys, and finally two of these guys coming together to make something that has two white dots and two black dots. And if you just do the math, there are going to be two of these black dots left over. So what are these things? We know it's called the hydrogen chain, and it's going to start with two protons, which are hydrogen nuclei, coming together. And the nu stands for neutrino. And this small dot is an antimatter electron, sometimes called a positron. So this thing here has two big things that are linked together. It's a type of hydrogen that's called deuterium. So it's a neutron and a proton bound together. So apparently this thing is a neutron. So then we have deuterium combining with a proton to make a nucleus that has two protons and one neutron. The number of protons determines the chemical element. And so this is going to be helium. And there are three things there, so it's called helium-3. You could call deuterium, if you wanted to, H2. Be perfectly allowed. So then we have two helium-3s coming together to make a nucleus that has two protons, so it's helium, and it's got four things in it, and that's garden variety helium. So two protons come together to make deuterium and a neutrino and an antimatter electron. Deuterium combines with a proton to make helium-3. Two helium-3s come together to make helium-4, and we have two protons that are left over. So here we're graphing things and we're looking at ratios of the amount of light and that sort of stuff. So I'm not sure we can reproduce this graph particularly accurately, but what we're told is that blue light is at 400 nanometers, which is 0.4 millionths of a meter, and red light is at 700 nanometers, which is 0.7, and we want to just read these things off. So it's a matter of going up 4 and reading over, and this graph doesn't at all match the one that's in this problem. But On this problem, it looks like you get 13 or something like that when you go up from 0.4. And when you go up from 0.7, okay, so let's just change this around so it looks more like the other one. Let's move the curve. Right, so we go up here and over and get something like 13, and we go up at 7 and over and we get something like 4. So the ratio of the amount of red light over the amount of blue light, that's going to be red over blue, 4 over 13. Okay, so the question you really asked about was 31. How does the temperature change these things? So how the temperature changes things is, you remember the light bulbs, when you reduce the temperature, there's less light at every wavelength. And also we go from white light to orange light to red light to light that we can't even see with our eyes. So as we go to larger, lower temperatures, that curve is going to shift like that, everywhere below the previous curve, and the peak is going to occur at a longer wavelength. So there's going to be less blue light, there's going to be less red light, and the ratio has to now be switching to more and more red and less blue. So that means the ratio of blue to red is going to be increasing. So if you keep the size the same and you just change the temperature, then it always has to be below the previous curve. And the peak has to shift to longer wavelength if we've reduced the temperature. More red light and less blue.
And if we like double the distance, then is it just...
So double the distance would have exactly the same relative amounts of those colors, yeah, but less at everything. So yeah. So there would now be, at every point, say half as much as there was before, so it'd have exactly the same shape, exactly the same peak, exactly the same ratio of red to blue, but less of everything. So reducing the temperature gives you less of everything, but it shifts the peak and changes the shape. Moving something further away also gives you less, but it doesn't change the peak. And I guess the other thing that sometimes is relevant to these sorts of problems is if there are absorption lines, they don't move with temperature because they have to do with the atomic energy level, which doesn't depend on temperature. Same exam? Oh, so this is the complicated formula question? Okay, so what we've got here is the temperature is equal to the temperature of the sun, the square root of the radius of the sun, divided by 2 times, I labeled it A, 2 times the distance between the planets, and then we've got 1 minus the albedo divided by the emissivity all to the 1/4. So again, this is the temperature of the sun. The things that have this as their symbol have to do with the sun. So this is the temperature of the sun, and this is the radius of the sun. And this A is how far we are from the sun, our so-called semi-major axis. So this A was called the albedo, and that's basically how reflective the sun is, how reflective the planet is. And this is the emissivity. And that's how emissive the planet is. Is it for the same temperature, is it emitting more or less light? So how would these things change? Well, I hope it's clear that these things that are in the numerator without minus signs, if I increase them, it's going to make things bigger. These things that are in the denominator, if I make them bigger, it's going to make the result smaller. This thing is being subtracted from 1, so if I make this thing bigger, there's a smaller number in the numerator, so there'd be a smaller number for the result. So what is this the temperature of, and how could the surface temperature differ from this formula temperature? So this is the temperature. So we always think of the sun as shining. So it has a surface that the light is being emitted from. The Earth is also shining, but it's not shining with visible light. It's shining with infrared light. And this is giving us the temperature of the surface that the Earth is, from which the Earth's light is shining from. And it turns out it's not at the surface, it's high up in the Earth's atmosphere, where the atmosphere becomes transparent to the sort of light that the Earth produces, namely infrared light. So if you were to take a picture with infrared light, you wouldn't see the surface, you'd see some upper atmospheric phenomena. And of course, it's warmer on the ground, basically because the ground is being heated. So we have the top of the blanket is this temperature here, high up in the Earth's atmosphere. The bottom of the ground is being heated by the sun's light, so it gets hotter than the top of the blanket. And this temperature difference between the top of the atmosphere and the bottom of the Earth's atmosphere, that's basically the greenhouse effect. So we like the greenhouse effect because it keeps us from freezing, because this temperature is typically below freezing, but maybe we don't want a whole lot of greenhouse effect. So a little bit of greenhouse effect is good.
What type of questions would you ask us about, like, the DNA and RNA and things like that? Like, do we need to know the protons and, you know, that they have a nucleus and all those types of things? Or, like, and we talked about that a good amount of time. I just don't understand what, or don't know what to expect from that.
Well, so what question could I ask about is not a fair question. But, so what things can we kind of absolutely rule out? So,
yeah.
So you asked particularly about DNA, and so we had a whole section about biological molecules, and you should be able to recognize those molecules and name those molecules, but because they have radically different shapes, but you shouldn't really be able to draw those. So if you, I won't ask you to draw the glucose molecule, but you should be able to recognize the glucose, to separate a glucose molecule from a fat molecule, right? The fat molecules are the ones that have long CH chains and no oxygen, and the sugar molecules are ones that are smallish, 5 or 6 carbons for typical sugars, and they're gonna have as much O as H and C. And so we had fats. Proteins are gonna have the carboxylic acid group and the amino group, so they've got nitrogen in them. Obviously you can't, so you could recognize a picture of DNA, but it's way complicated to actually draw in terms of this atom is connected to that atom. So another kind of DNA RNA question might have to do with what's called central dogma, the idea that DNA codes for RNA and it's the RNA that codes into is converted into protein on ribosomes. And of course, I guess a shorter answer would be to say, you know, the things that were on the review board for the next day, which I suspect are pretty much what I've just said.
Can we go over energy on the sun, like in different layers of the suns, like the radiative zone, the convective zone, like the corona?
Mm-hmm. So the layers of the sun, so there's the core of the sun, and that's the only place that is hot enough and dense enough for the thermonuclear reactions to run. So that's the only place where hydrogen is being burned into helium. And all of this material is actually still material. It's not moving. What's happening is the energy that's being produced in the core is radiating through these layers so far. And the arrow I've drawn is actually kind of the wrong story. Even though the material is still and the light is shining through it, it doesn't go very far before it's absorbed. So the light is actually kind of taking a really random walk out. It takes on the order of 1 million years for the light to go from the core through this still material. The outer, say, third of the sun is convecting. So that's this kind of boiling that we can see in the form of granules on the visible surface of the sun, which is called the photosphere. So just as the Earth's atmosphere is a very small fraction of the radius of the Earth, the photosphere is a very small fraction of the size of the sun, but it's actually bigger than the Earth. It's thicker than the Earth. So above that, we have the chromosphere. And these layers are kind of like the troposphere and the stratosphere. That is to say, the photosphere, as we're, if we make a graph of temperature, obviously as we've been going up in the sun's atmosphere, it's been getting colder and colder and colder, and then it turns around at some point and starts to get warmer. So where it gets a little bit, starts to get a little bit warmer, that's the chromosphere. And it's named for the red excited hydrogen gas that we see in eclipses at that time. And then suddenly it gets way hot, like 2 million degrees hot. So the surface of the sun is like 6,000 degrees hot, and the chromosphere is maybe 10,000 degrees hot. This sun zooming to super high temperatures, that's the sign that we're in the corona. And the corona is quite extended, you know, maybe as much as the radius of the sun. It doesn't have a regular boundary. Sometimes pieces of the corona are ejected, those coronal mass ejections that can cause aurora on Earth.
Wait, and then when they say they're trying to figure out how the corona is heated, and it might have to do with radiation inside the sun, like somehow getting...
Well, I don't quite like the word radiation. Sound is what I would say.
Oh.
Because this piece of the sun is opaque to light, so light isn't going to go. So we need. It turns out that the temperature of the corona is pretty much the same as the temperature there, and so it must be that the stuff here is somehow heating the stuff there. There has to be some sort of connection between those sorts of material, and it can't be light that's doing the connection because the material is opaque.
And it's somehow skipping the...
Yeah, so it must be, whatever is doing this must be more or less transparent to all of that material, and sound is the, some sort of magnetized sound is the candidate possibility. Somehow or other, the magnetic field is being stirred at that level, and that stirring of the magnetic field is causing heating in the corona. But the exactly how that works, they haven't figured out.
Well, can we go over like sunspots and like how magnetism?
Hmm. So So typically, if we look at the surface of the sun, so what are sunspots? They are regions that are not taking part in the convection because they're being magnetically confined. And they're just maybe 1,000 degrees cooler than the temperature of the surface of the sun, and so they look dimmer. They very frequently come in pairs. And kind of the what we think is if was happening in cross-section is the magnetic field is kind of looping around. And so we get this region that is magnetically confined, and we get this region that's magnetically confined, and they have opposite polarities, north and south. So sunspots kind of come and go on this 11-year cycle, 22-year reversal of the magnetic field of the sun overall. So other kind of surface features that we've talked about were the granules. So those are the tops of the convection cells that are a little bit hotter and cooler. We've got prominences. Filaments are prominences looked at not on the edge of the sun, in which case they look dark. We've got spicules. Spicules, I think that's how you spell it. That's kind of like fingers of, looks kind of like grass. Lots of zillions of fingers of material that is kind of peeking out and kind of connecting together the photosphere and the corona or the chromosphere. And of course, we had sunspots. Oh, flares. coronal mass ejections. I think those are kind of the surface things that we talked about.
Wait, do they start at the photosphere and then break through all the way through the corona? Or?
So the coronal mass ejections?
Yeah.
So the energy release seems to be kind of in the boundary between the photosphere and the photosphere and the chromosphere, but the material that's ejected is kind of ejected through the corona per se. So the action isn't so much happening in the corona. The action is closer to the sun, and we're blowing off a bit of that material out in a random direction, which might intercept the Earth. So in terms of tons, it's a lot of material that's being ejected, but it's pretty rarefied gas by the time it hits the Earth. So particularly the flares and the prominences and the spots are magnetically related. And they kind of come together in what are called active regions, where regions where you would have flares and sunspots and potential coronal mass ejections, which are kind of just like super flares. The light follows the...
How does where does that depend? Because I know it always points at the sun, but...
Oh, how you figure out, you know, kind of gibbous moon and that sort of thing? Which way is the white pointing?
Yeah.
So the white, if we're thinking about a crescent moon, you can think about it as kind of a bow. And if you shoot an arrow from that bow, you should hit the sun. So I at least typically think about seeing a waxing crescent moon when the sun is setting in the west. So the crescent phase is the angle between the moon and the sun is relatively small. And so if there were a crescent moon here, it would look kind of like that, so that if I followed the arrow, it should point to the sun. Now, if we have this setting sun over here in the east, we could have a gibbous phase. And it might look kind of like that. And it's a long shot. But if you go up and over from that white, you should also directly point to the sun. Another way of maybe getting a handle on this is the direct path. So approximately speaking, the moon is on the ecliptic too, right? It's really plus minus 10 degrees. So in some sense, the ecliptic is the straight line that connects the moon to the sun. And this pattern should be basically perpendicular to the ecliptic. So a half moon, for example, that was on the meridian would look kind of like that. Right, so white on the right, those are the waxing phases, and white on the left, those are the waning phases in the northern hemisphere. So that movie Melancholia had this planet that was in the same direction as the sun, but wasn't a crescent. It was a full planet, which is not possible.
Wait, what was it?
So there's this movie Melancholia where a new planet comes through the solar system and wipes out the Earth, but before it does, we have time to make this movie. And so there... And there are pictures of this planet as it approaches the Earth and passes it by and then comes back and whacks it. And basically all of them are not possible. because it can't be fundamentally any different from the moon. So if it's in the same direction as the sun, it better be a crescent. So all of the premises of that movie are wrong. If you were in doubt.
Can you possibly go through the from the beginning of the chapters when we did the whole mapping of the star and the
what I would call the culmination problem.
Yeah, the culmination problem.
The first 10-point question on those exams. So let me remind you that a good place to study up on that are those online things, because there are lots of examples there. Mm-hmm. So the question is basically when, that is to say what time of day, is a star going to culminate, and what culminate means is that it's as high as it's ever going to be in the sky, which happens when it's on the meridian. And the meridian is the line in the sky that goes from north through the north celestial pole through zenith and back through south. And the other question we're going to ask is its altitude at that time. And my feeling is that this question is the easier question to answer. And the way I always recommend doing it is drawing the meridian. So here we are standing under zenith, and we'll let this be the north celestial pole, and we know that the altitude of the north celestial pole is equal to our latitude, and the celestial equator goes around the other way. It has to be perpendicular to the pole, and so the angle the celestial equator misses zenith by also has to be our latitude. The angle towards the north pole or away from the north pole, that's what we mean by the declination. So if we pick a star, probably won't be a new one, but only so many stars to choose from that are nice. Regulus is a nice star. So Regulus has a declination of, say 12 degrees. And it has a right ascension that, well, close enough to 10 hours. So the fact that that's a positive, and where? So let's do this in Canada someplace where the latitude is 50 degrees. So the fact that the declination is positive means that, so let me point out where this star is. So here's the celestial equator, and here's Regulus. It's north of the celestial equator. Positive declination. So this star has a declination of 12 degrees, I said, huh? And we said that we're at a latitude of 50 degrees, and what we want to find is the altitude, which is the angle above the nearest horizon, which is in this case the southern horizon. And once you've drawn that picture, it should just be kind of a matter of adding and subtracting things. So if this is 50 degrees, then that has to be 40 degrees, and we're 12 more degrees than that. So it must be that the altitude is 40 plus 12, or 52 degrees. Things get a little bit more interesting if the declination pushes you past zenith, right? Then you want to go to the nearest horizon, which will be the north horizon. We always go to the nearest horizon. Yes, so that's what I consider the harder question. And the first simplification, I guess, that I use is I promise I'm going to choose a 21. And we have this little table that we've memorized that gives us the right ascension and the declination of the sun on various standard dates. The first day of spring, 21 March. By definition, the right ascension is zero, and it's an equinox, so it's on the celestial equator and has a declination zero. 21 June It is 1/4 of the way around, so it has a right ascension of 6 hours, and the declination is going to be as high as the ecliptic gets, which is plus 23.5 degrees. Right, so the ecliptic is this kind of sine curve here. So here's RA 0, here's an RA of 6 hours plus 23.5 degrees. Then we've got the fall equinox, 21 September. We're halfway around, we're back on the celestial equator. And then we've got the summer or the winter solstice, 18 hours. The sun is as low in the sky as it's ever going to be at minus 23.5 degrees. So pick a date.
June 21st.
Don't pick June 21st. Pick something that's not on the calendar. Not on this table. So we have to go 2 hours per month for practice.
October 14th.
No. We could do the 14th, but I don't think you want to. October 21. So we start with figuring out where is the sun. So a month before, the sun was at 12 hours. So that means that at this time, 24 hours, 12 months, it's got to be at 14 hours. So that means that at noon, the right ascension that's on the meridian has to be that number that we just calculated, which is 14 hours. And we need to work our way backwards to 10 hours. And so let's go backwards. So the whole celestial sphere rotates 1 hour of right ascension per hour of time. So at 11 a.m., 13 hours was on the meridian. And at 10 a.m., 12 hours was on the meridian. And at 9 a.m., 11 hours was on the meridian. And so at 8 a.m., 10 hours will be on the meridian. So Regulus should be on the meridian on October 21 at 8 a.m. So 2 hours per month, that's how the sun is moving. Every day the celestial sphere rotates 1 hour of right ascension per hour of time. So we started with the fact that the sun is high noon, right? The sun is on the meridian at noon, and it had a right ascension of 14 hours. Mm-hmm. So the object we're interested in has a right ascension of 10 hours.
Oh, right. Okay. I got it now. Thank you.
Okay. So it's already passed, and we have to unrotate 1 hour of right ascension per hour of time before we can get 10 hours on the meridian. It's too late, right? By then I will have made up the... for the grading of the exam. Well, but I'm in the process of weaning out questions. So I guess you're saying I could wean out the hard ones and leave the easy ones. So lots of old questions on there. Obviously some new ones, but lots of old ones. That's the best way to start, is by figuring out your old exams. Yeah, they're online. Oh, you mean your old exams?
Yeah.
I'll put them in with the lecture stuff if they're not there.
Okay.
I can't remember if I did that or not. I was hoping you retained your old exams.
No, I still have them, yes. I was wondering if you had gone through them yourself, like you had the other ones.
Oh, screencasts? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're for sure screencasts of them. Okay. They're in the lecture area.
Okay. So the ones that we've already taken have already been screencasted?
Yes.
Okay. I'll just look at that. Because I've only found the 212 and 211, not the ones that we have taken, but the past ones.
Yeah. So what you want to do is to click on lectures on the main page, and then your options are 211 or 212.
Right.
And you want to take the 211, and then your options are 2011 or 2012, and obviously you want to take 2012. And then there'll be a long list of all of these recorded lectures, but in there, there'll be 3x3 MP4s that are, as opposed to MPAs, that are screencasts of your exams.
Thank you.
So you're not after the PDFs of the hard copy, you're after the screencasts.
Right.
Okay.
Are there any like hard copies of like old finals that we can look at, or no?
I think it's better to look at your old exams than old finals. So no, there aren't any.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Thanks for reminding me.